Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very, very well. How are you?
I'm well. I want to talk about with our audience the two businesses that we sort of noticed in the times that I know you emailed me about that I thought are really cool. One is Insomnia Cookies at 50 West 8th Street in Manhattan. It's a chain. The chain is a fixture on college campuses, but now it's expanding its service beyond NYU, which was its original base in New York, and they deliver cookies, hot cookies.
Not just cookies. Warm cookies that they deliver to you still warm, and if you want them to, they will also deliver you cold milk.
Yeah, that's great. And they deliver them until 3 o'clock in the morning.
It's brilliant. Okay. There's no other word for a company that will bring you warm cookies except for brilliance. Now, I have never had the cookies. I don't know if they're good, bad, or indifferent. But what I will tell you is that if there were a company here in New Jersey who would bring me warm cookies right now, I would be dialing the phone as we speak.
And you could hear them being delivered. Mark rifling through his pocket.
You'd
for a
be
tip.
Delivering me cookies twice a week at a minimum.
Insomnia Cookies, they deliver the cookies. The deliverymen have insulated containers, so they still stay warm. The cookies are 90 cents a piece, and brownies are $1 plus 25 cents for toppings. They're large, they're warm, and...
Much like me.
But yeah, exactly. No, not at all. Much more desirable than you. Now, I think this is a pretty fabulous idea.
I think it is a great idea. Again, I don't know if it's executed well. I cannot attest to any of that. What I can tell you is, as far as concept goes, it's brilliant.
You know, I have in my refrigerator at home, I have some Ronnybrook Farms milk. And in my freezer at home, I use Fresh Direct. Because mm-hmm. I'm in a neighborhood in Jersey City where we can get Fresh Direct. They have some products that are their own. They're branded as Fresh Direct products that you can order. And we experimented this week with frozen chocolate chip cookies.
Oh, great.
Now, what they are is it's a 2-quart container with nuggets of already formed frozen chocolate chip cookie dough.
Oh, sure. Sure. Now, basically Nestle Toll House Log.
Basically, except better. See, we used to get the Nestle Toll House Log once in a while. We keep it in there, throw a pop a couple in the toaster oven, and they're good.
Can I tell you a little secret, though?
Yeah.
My wife makes incredibly good cookie dough.
Keep it in the freezer?
We just keep it in the freezer.
Mm-hmm. If I were at your house, I'd go to your freezer.
It really works. But can I tell you something else?
Yeah.
Even with that cookie dough in the freezer, if someone told me they were going to just bring me cookies.
No. If I have the dough, I don't need them. Mm-hmm. But I often come home at 2 in the morning and there's no dough left. And
I guess you're saying something about your betrothed.
I have to recommend Fresh Direct. No, it's usually me that ate them. but with Fresh Direct, look, the Nestle's Toll House Log is, you know, that's fine. Mm-hmm. It's fine, but the chocolate is really kind of unremarkable. It's okay, but it's sort of unremarkable. But, you know, a warm cookie is a warm cookie.
Right.
With the Fresh Direct cookies, the chocolate in them is just delicious.
Yeah.
And you defrost them for 15 minutes, and then you cook them for 15 minutes, and then you let them cool for 10 minutes, and they're just remarkable. One of the great pleasures of the world.
See, but in that 40 minutes,
yeah.
Insomnia Cookies could have brought me some.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, you know, you're not going to get there in less than 40 minutes. All right, next business that opened up, which is kind of unusual, this is all from Florence Fabricant's column in the New York Times. With burlap sacks in his window, Jason Applebaum has turned the retail part of his catering business, Chef & Company, into Totally Baked, a potato bar.
See, I'm not as into that.
A potato bar.
That doesn't strike me as...
I'm an Irishman. I like potatoes. I like bars. I don't see the potato bar.
You know what? I'm sure that it's great, and I'm sure that it's very well executed. But
I don't know. It just Insomnia Cookie sounds like you put those two ideas on a on you know
they deliver the potatoes.
The big idea and see which one's going to win. Mm-hmm. And I think InsomniaCookies.com wins.
Well, here's the deal. Big round. Here's what they serve: big round gold Yukon gold potatoes. They're baked, partially scooped out, and served in nifty little boxes that they picture here. 18 possible toppings, including wild mushrooms with shallots, cream spinach with frizzled leeks and manchego cheese, or pulled pork topped with a Mexican slaw. The potatoes are $7 to $11 each, and they each come with a small salad. Looking at these things, they really do look like a normal. Like you'd have them for dinner. You could
and
have one for dinner.
And it sounds good. I'm, you know, it sounds good. It just it, when I'm thinking about conceptually, what am I going to do? I might order this from this cookie company twice a week. I might have one of those potatoes every 6 months.
I think that you need to live in a neighborhood with the potato bar. You need to be walking by the potato
right.
bar on the way home.
Right. You're not crave. You know, I don't crave baked potatoes as I'm walking down the street. I don't think, oh my goodness, if I only had a baked potato right now, my day would be complete.
And you know the problem with the potato bar, I think, and I wish them well. I mean, Godspeed.
I know what the problem with the potato bar is.
What?
No bar.
It's, exactly. Now, if you put a potato bar in the back of your bar, in the back of an Irish bar as a concept thing, who knows? But, you know, here's the other problem with a potato bar. Big hunkin' steam. You serve one thing. Can mm-hmm. that one thing be a potato? And you know what? In November, big hunk of steaming potato with a little bit of meat on it.
Sounds kind of yummy.
How about July?
How about July? It's 104 degrees. Can I get you your baked potato now?
I don't think July in Manhattan we're going to go with a...
Maybe a schlock of cream cheese right there. Cream cheese of sour cream right on top there.
You know, it's funny. We talk about delivery. One of the things I think that's happening more and more, I know we're being asked to do more of it,
mm-hmm.
is people are asking... their favorite restaurant to cater something.
Sure.
Even small events, people will say, you know, we're having 30 people over on Saturday or 20 people over Saturday. Can you either come and present something or come and cook dinner for
right.
us?
Even, you know, even to-go food I'm seeing more and more of. I see Kathleen Lombardi, obviously, is a great venue for to-go food. Stage Left, frankly, is not a very good venue for to-go food. And we see that constantly. I'm constantly getting requests for Stage Left to go food or Kathleen Lombardi to go food, and sometimes my answer to somebody at Stage Left is, you know what, it's that particular dish just isn't going to travel.
Right, yeah. That's
and it's a shame because I know
seared foie gras by the time you get it home, it's just a piece of cold liver.
Right,
you know what I mean?
It's not, precisely.
It's got a. There are certain things we do in Stage Left that like we take off the pan and like the waiter runs to the table to get mm-hmm. it to you in pristine condition, and that's
he's got about 4 minutes before it. It changes.
But I think people really are integrating restaurants more into their life. And I think and people are asking us to do things at their house, whether it's to cater a cocktail party by sending mm-hmm. a bartender and a couple mm-hmm. of our specialty cocktails, or whether it's to, you know, cater something in their backyard or even send someone to cook dinner for a very important dinner at home. We get requests like that a lot. And it's very interesting how people have made us part of their lives. And I know other restaurants are getting them as
well.
It's
fun to do, too. It's also fun to do those novel things and to be outside the restaurant trying to recreate some of the things that we do in the restaurant.
I especially find the cocktail thing interesting. We're going to be participating in the Taste of the Nation, the Share Our Strength Taste of the mm-hmm. Nation down in Princeton relatively soon. And we have a couple of other commitments that evening, and so we decided in this year, instead of presenting a dish, we're going
to
go make one of our specialty cocktails. They were thrilled with the mm-hmm. with the idea, and we are too, because we're seeing a call for this more and more. A couple of benefits, other charity benefits, mm-hmm. we've gone and presented two of our cocktails, made them fresh with egg white and Aperol and ingredients, some originals or some classics, and you know, people absolutely love it. So.
Well, I think what's a cocktail party without a great cocktail?
I'm in, and without a great bartender. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment with Mark Vetri. He is one of the top chefs in Philadelphia and one of the most important Italian chefs in the country. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And today our guest is Mark Vetri. He's chef owner of Vetri and Osteria Restaurants in Philadelphia. He's one of the best chefs in the country. Philadelphia Magazine just ranked in the top 50 restaurants in Philadelphia. And Vetri and Osteria both made the top 10. I've eaten at Vetri a number of times. Extraordinary place.
Mark Vetri, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, man, it's great. Now, you're in Philly. A lot of folks say that you're the best chef in Philly.
Well, I don't know about that, you know. We're having a lot of fun, and that's actually what it's all about.
Well, let's talk about Philadelphia as a city.
Sure.
Because, 15 years ago, Philadelphia really wasn't known as a culinary destination and was sort of a...
I mean, 15 years ago, there was... I don't know when the bath opened up.
Right
about then, yeah. You know, I actually kind of think that that's when it all... really started. I mean, obviously, there was Lebec's been here for years.
Right. I mean, basically, you had George Perrier and not a lot else going on in Philadelphia as far as great restaurants go. You know, it was a city, so you always had restaurants going on. But
but
I think that kind of surge came right about the time Striped Bass opened.
Yeah,
I agree.
Right about then, and then it started to take off. I don't really remember a lot of the other, kind of restaurants that. It helped the whole start of it. But I actually came in 5 years after that, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
When I was looking to open, when I left Philly, that was, I guess, back in 1990, Philly was just,
There was no culinary sort of sensibility even to the place.
No.
Except for, of course, the cheesesteaks, which were always very good.
Well, yeah, and they still are, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent.
Well, now, what was it like for you when you opened Vetri? Because I think that, Striped Bass started sort of a restaurant, renaissance in Philadelphia. But most of the places that, or at least from what I see, many of the places that were, when you opened Vetri, garnering attention as the places to be, were sort of high-budget, big, modern places. Vetri is very homey, very intimate.
It's not what you think of when you think of high profile, best chef in a city.
I mean, it was actually, when I wanted to open up something, I was actually looking at all these larger bases, and I actually looked at the restaurant called, I think, Joseph's on the Avenue. It was this really large restaurant space, and I had some investors who wanted money. But, the more I looked around, the more I was like, this isn't really what I'm looking for.
So why did you decide for such kind of a small, intimate place?
I was actually looking around, and then I actually heard that the restaurant was called Chanterelle. And I had heard that they were looking to sell, so I stopped over there just on a whim. And honestly, once I just walked into it, and I just knew right away that that was it. I just kind of fell in love with it right away. It was really, really little. It had 35. And everything was just exactly what I remembered coming from Italy, where it was that small kind of unique style that I really liked.
I read somewhere, and you can tell me whether this is true or not, that it is a small restaurant, obviously, and you have sort of outsized success for such a small restaurant. I hear that one of your big things is goat, right? And is it true that you spit roast the goat in your parking lot?
Yeah, well, we used to, but we had a little bit of a fire out there. So,
if you're going to have a fire...
We did it for like 5 years, and it was awesome. But then one of the ashes kind of got out and went up to the roof.
Started
a little thing. So now we smoke it inside, and then we roast it in the oven.
If you're going to have a fire, though, you want to have it in your parking lot, not
exactly.
In your restaurant.
Exactly. Okay? Yeah, nothing major happened. We got lucky. But just getting back to the restaurant also, it's, having that the little restaurant made it that my ex didn't have to have any investors or anything. So I was able to open it.
It got to be your own without lots of other people's input.
Alone, and that's really kind of rare nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. Believe me, our restaurants would be a lot better if Francis had never gotten involved.
No doubt
about it. If this was the Mark Pascal show.
They stick in $50 and they think they own half the place.
Well, now your place, it is your own. It's very personal. I remember one of the things that when I went there that you did was you have a tasting menu. When you order the tasting menu at your restaurant, usually when tasting menus come out to a table, the same thing comes out to each diner at the table. In your restaurant, if there are four diners, there might be four different things that come out with each course.
There might be, and that's all kind of really up to how you are, basically, because we like to read you a little bit, so if the server is kind of out there and everyone's like, oh, let us have anything, and, we'd love this, but, we'd also like this, but we'd also like this, but we'd also like this, we're going to kind of mix it up a little bit for you.
So if the diners seem more adventurous, you'll ride that way.
But if they're kind of like, I don't need this, I don't need that, and I really don't like this, and I'm not into it, you know, then you know, we still want you to really have a nice evening.
You adjust it for the diner.
Hey, right, you want to adjust it for them, for sure.
Hey, listen, we need to take a quick break. We'll be right back talking with Mark Vetri, a Vetri restaurant in Philadelphia in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Mark Vetri, one of the most celebrated chefs of Philadelphia and one of the best chefs in the country. His restaurants are Vetri and Osteria. You can find out more about them through our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We recommend them highly. So we've heard a rumor, Mark. The rumor mill says that there might be a charcuterie shop that you might be opening up very soon.
I don't know if you heard that from.
We're the restaurant guys. We know all the
things. Wow. You know, there's a lot of rumors going around. I would love to open up something like that. And we're always looking at open spaces. But if I was to open up something next, it would probably be something along those lines. The last couple of years really into making our own sausages and all kinds of things like that, and we've been really having a lot of fun with it.
I hear that you cure your own meats and you eat your own meats there. How does that work, especially in such a small space?
We were able to kind of make another walk-in more or less downstairs and actually studying it for a while, and so we started about a couple of years ago, and it's actually really taken off well. We've been making our own sopressata and lardo and pancetta, and we have about 6 or 7 different items on the meat plate.
Lardo's one of those really underappreciated things. I think some people don't realize what goes into it and how long a process it is.
We really have to leave that in the salt for like 8-9 months. So when you figure that you have to kind of spend some money on something and then leave it for 8 or 9 months.
See you in a year. Okay, let's go.
Yeah, you know, see you in a year. Hopefully, the restaurant will still be open when we sell it.
Well, you know, speaking of which, Vetri is notoriously a difficult reservation to get. I mean, you're a small place, and you haven't really gone crazy in expanding. Did you ever think you'd be so successful?
No, not in a million years. I mean, it's actually just one of those things that I still think about, and I'm like, I don't really understand how it has taken on the mystique that it actually has now.
Well, part of the
understand it.
Part of the way is by not expanding too fast. You didn't open your second restaurant until you were, very well established.
Yeah, we were open for 10 years.
Ten years. And your first restaurant's very small and very, very hard to get into, and a lot of people want to get there.
You know what else I think? I've actually learned this from opening up the larger restaurant. There is something really nice about the room, the ambiance. I mean, we serve really wonderful food over at Osteria, and we could really serve the exact same thing here, and you would look at it like, wow, this is the most amazing thing ever, you know, just for the reason that, you know, you're eating it where you're eating it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, it's a very intimate setting, and that's important.
Yes.
It makes the food more intimate.
It's more about the food, and I think a lot of restaurateurs, they don't understand that it's not only the awesome food that you have to have the right ambiance, the right lighting, the right service, the right lights, the right flowers, the right everything, you know?
Well, you know, what's funny is that, Mark, the only reason we really had you on the show is because Mark and I want to be able to get reservations at
Vetri. I think I have something open in about 3 or 4 months.
All right, we'll see you in 3 or 4 months then. All right, then.
Hey, Mark, I want to thank you for coming on the show. It was great to have you.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Mark Vetri.
Thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome. Mark Vetri is chef owner of Vetri and Osteria restaurants in Philadelphia. If you're anywhere near there, you'd be a sin to drive by and not stop in and have a meal. We'll be back after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
It's Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
In the first half of today's show, we talked with Chef Mark Vetri from Philadelphia, one of the best chefs in the country. And we're going to turn our attention now to a different guest. We have Dr. Elizabeth Babcock with us. She is the chief scientist of the Pew Institute for Ocean Science, and she's co-editor of a new book called Sharks of the Open Ocean, which is released on March 28th of this year. She joins us to discuss the book and the fate of ocean-going sharks all over the world.
Dr. Babcock, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So sharks are really mean and they bite people. Why do we care if they're going extinct?
Well, one good reason to care about sharks is that they're an integral part of marine ecosystems. You can't have a healthy marine ecosystem without sharks any more than you can have a healthy ecosystem on land without things like lions and tigers and bears, which also are dangerous and might bite people.
But sharks eat things like tuna and other fish that we might, as human beings, otherwise eat. So what makes us care that the sharks might be gone? How might that affect an ecosystem?
Well, one example is we have a project we're working on in Belize in Central America, and we found that in marine protected areas, the nurse sharks, which eat lobsters and other invertebrates, have increased in the marine protected areas, but the larger sharks, like tiger sharks, which would be eating the nurse sharks, aren't protected by the marine protected area because they move around a lot. So what's actually happening is a buildup of nurse sharks that are eating the lobsters and the conchs that that people could be harvesting if they weren't being eaten by the nurse sharks. So it would be great if the tiger shark population was a little bit higher to control the nurse shark population. That's the kind of interaction that happens in the ocean, and the sharks are very important to maintain the balance.
It's almost like a system. We should call it an ecosystem, I think.
Exactly.
now the sharks are called an apex predator, right? They're at the top of the food chain in the water of swimming
things.
And what is the state of sharks today?
Well, a lot of the sharks have been severely depleted by fishing. One of the problem with being an apex predator is that sharks have not evolved with predators of their own. That's what apex predator means. So they really aren't very productive compared to things that are lower in the food chain, like sardines that they're used to having most of their population eaten every year.
Sounds like a human being. Not very productive, used to,
No, but you mean not very productive and
right.
Not many offspring, right?
Yeah, exactly. So sharks really don't have the capacity to withstand a fishery the way something like a cod or a sardine would.
Now, the sharks are caught, and I don't really eat shark. I don't really dig eating shark just because I've butchered and cleaned some sharks, and there's stuff in there that I don't really care to. even when I pull it out, it was in there once. I don't really care for it. But it's not just people who are fishing for sharks for food. Sharks are particularly devastated as bycatch. Is that correct or no?
That's right. Sharks are pretty much everywhere you go in the ocean, even in the high seas. So they are caught as bycatch in the longline fisheries in the high seas that are targeting things like swordfish and tunas, bluefin tuna, yellowfin tuna. Those vessels catch sharks, and whether they want the sharks or not, the sharks are there, they're on the line, they're dead. So it's a serious problem.
Well, let's talk about what exactly bycatch is, and let's also talk about why the sharks would be dead on the lines when they're brought up. Because most of us think about sports fishing. If you catch something on your line that you don't want, you can either just cut it off or you can bring it up to your boat, unhook it, and then send it back on its way.
Right, and the same thing can happen in commercial fisheries, but the problem is the scale is much greater. A commercial long line can be hundreds of hooks spread out over many kilometers of line, and they'll soak them all night and then haul them in the morning, and it takes hours to pull them in, so a lot of sharks just can't withstand being on a hook that long, so they're dead when they come to the boat. Some species can survive that kind of treatment, but most of them can't.
Some of these long lines are miles and miles and miles long, though.
Exactly. They're huge. And they're all over. There's a someone calculated how many millions of hooks there are in the Atlantic Ocean at any one time. It's astonishing, really, how many are out there.
Well, you know, one of the things that we've talked about is modern methods of fishing have the ability. I mean, if we were to just go all out and pour everything we could into our fishing fleet, we could basically fish the oceans clean in less than a decade if we set our mind to it.
That's exactly the problem because... Yeah, you know, we don't have fewer fishermen now that we have fishing technology that's so much more effective. So every year it becomes easier and easier to catch way too many fish.
So what's going on with the shark population? Tell us what's happening out there in both oceanic sharks and sharks that are closer to shore.
Well, a lot of them are seriously depleted. Things like poor beagle shark, which used to be very popular to eat. It's one of the ones that actually tastes good. Are severely depleted all over the Atlantic. Mako sharks seem to be declining. There are some species like blue sharks that we think are pretty stable, but most of the ones, if we have any data, the data is showing the populations are going down.
So are we having more problem with the sharks that live closer to coastlines, or are we having more problems with the sharks that cross the oceans?
Well, it can go either way. Some of the coastal sharks are badly overfished. But we have more information about the ones that are closer to land. You know, it's very hard to study something like a blue shark that can travel from New England to Spain and back, and they spend a lot of their time hundreds of miles from shore. So we actually have some pretty good information about some of the depleted coastal populations, like sand tiger sharks, for example. But the open ocean sharks, they're kind of exposed to just as much fishing pressure, and we have less information about them, so we can't. We can't prove that they're in worse shape, but we're kind of concerned because of the lack of data. And that was one of the things that we wanted to establish with this book that we wrote, is to try to get together all the data that exists for open ocean sharks and just see how much of a problem we've got.
Well, now, you've made available to us several chapters of your book, which we read and are fascinating, but we haven't seen the whole thing yet. It should be available online, and we'll certainly put a link up on our website where people can go and buy the book. But talk to people about the purpose of the book and what's in it and who's your target audience.
The purpose of the book is just to draw attention to the sharks of the open ocean and to bring together all the data that are available, just because we felt that the open ocean sharks were, they were kind of falling through the cracks because not so many people studied them. The target audience, is mainly academics and environmental NGOs, people who really want all the technical details about sharks. So there are chapters in here about, shark mating systems and fishing technology that can be used to reduce shark bycatch, all sorts of very technical things. There are also some chapters that are just explaining the conservation status of all these species. So I think it's, anyone who's really interested in shark biology, I think would find this book interesting. It may be a little bit technical for people who just want to read an interesting book about sharks.
Yeah, it's not a recipe book.
I found the mating section very racy. the things that you talk about, there are methods of fishing that can reduce bycatch, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. There's a very interesting chapter in the book about a method where, which they tested in a longline fishery in Alaska, where they made an artificial bait that's, instead of baiting the longline hooks with squid or some kind of fish, they baited them with this artificial stuff that's like a gelatinous substance made out of some proprietary industrial process. This artificial bait actually attracted the cod and other finfish that they were targeting, and the sharks didn't like it, so they caught hardly any.
Is it much more expensive to implement something like that?
Well, at this point, it's still in the testing stage, so there isn't the artificial bait isn't commercially available. It would be more expensive than the regular squid and other baits that are commonly used, but it has a lot of potential. It would obviously the price would come down if it started to be used in the fisheries.
Now, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about there's a major distinction between the sharks that you find near shore and ocean-going sharks, as you mentioned, that, it can be transcontinental travelers through the oceans, which I think is pretty fascinating. But we'll talk more about that with Dr. Elizabeth Babcock of the Pew Institute for Ocean Science in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:45. I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 US patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953. Hey everybody, welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Babcock. She is the chief scientist of the Pew Institute for Ocean Science. They have a new book out called Sharks of the Open Ocean. Now, there are two different kinds of sharks, aren't there, Elizabeth? There's the sharks that sort of stick close to shore, and then there are sort of transoceanic sharks. And this talks about your book is concentrating on the sharks that go out into the open waters. How far do these sharks travel, and how different are they than the sharks that stay close to shore?
Well, there are many different species of sharks, and some of them are more coastal than others. There are some species, like white sharks, that we always thought of them as a coastal shark because people see them near shore. They're famous for killing sea lions right off the coast of South Africa or off California. But recently,
don't forget about that movie that in Amityville, Long Island.
That's right, yes. They used to be quite common in Long Island. Anyway, so we thought of them as a coastal species, but recent work with satellite tags have shown that they actually, sharks tagged in California have gone to Hawaii, and sharks tagged in South Africa have gone to New Zealand. So they actually spend a lot of time out in the open ocean. And then there are species like the oceanic white-tip shark, for example, which you'll never see one unless you're many miles offshore.
Hmm.
Those species are really very different. They never come into coastal waters, and they spend their whole life out in the open water, which is it kind of interesting when you think about it, that they could live so far from land in an environment that's very different from what we think of as.
Why don't you talk about how different the oceanic, the deep waters of the ocean are compared to the coastal waters? What are some of the differences that exist out there?
Well, most waters in the open ocean are a lot less productive in terms of plankton growing. There's a lot more nutrients in coastal waters because of upwelling and because the water is more shallow. So the open ocean is in some ways a bit of a desert. There aren't these areas with very high productivity and lots of fish biomass, but there are currents that move around, and along the edges of the currents, eddies will form, and those form areas where there's a little bit more productivity. And first the plankton accumulate, and then fish and birds and sharks and things come in and take advantage of that hot spot while it's there. So it's very dynamic. It's kind of like a desert with oases here and there, except the oases move around. And
so those hot spots kind of come and go.
Exactly. So that's why the sharks are acclimated to travel long distances, because they're used to moving around in this very dynamic environment.
Well, now let's talk about something that I find particularly disturbing. I mean, if we see shark on a menu, I mean, obviously we see sharks on menus in restaurants all the time, but a particular specialty is shark fin soup. So the shark fin is supposed to have, qualities beyond just the taste. It's supposed to, have medicinal properties and invigorating properties. But the demand for shark fins has led to a particularly onerous type of and disturbing type of fishing pressure on sharks. Can you tell us about the shark fin soup, the demand for shark fins worldwide, and how shark fins are harvested?
Right. The problem with shark fin soup is that there's just a huge demand for it. It's something that's very popular in Asia, and it's always been expensive. It's always been a luxury good, like the equivalent of caviar. But now, with growing wealth in Hong Kong and China, there's just every year there's more demand for shark fins, and the price goes up. So the fins of a shark are worth a lot more than the whole rest of the body. So there's an incentive for fishermen to just chop off the fins and throw the rest of the shark back in the ocean.
Well, the idea being you're already out at sea. You can gather a lot more fins than you can. The sharks take up a lot more room on your boat, and the entire body of the shark is not worth as much as just its fin.
Yeah, that's right. And the fins are actually dried, so you can chop off the fins and dry them on the back deck of your boat while you're fishing for swordfish or bluefin tuna or whatever. The target species are what go in the hold, and the fins you just dry on deck and sell them for some extra money. That's actually illegal now in a lot of places. The USA, for example, has a law against finning, which means that it's still okay to catch sharks and kill them, but you have to keep the whole animal. You can't just keep the fins.
But is shark finning still going on?
Well, the shark fin trade is still going on, of course.
But I mean, is that type of harvesting a shark for its fin and then throwing the finless shark, which dies, back in the water? Is that still happening in international waters?
It does still happen. There's most of the tuna commissions now, the international bodies that manage the high seas fisheries, most of them have bans on finning, but. You know, obviously, it's very hard to enforce something that happens on the high seas, some nations are better than others at enforcing it, and even the nations that try to enforce those laws, it's hard to stop a boat from finning and then selling their fins to, some freighter somewhere. It's a very difficult enforcement problem.
I mean, to try and take an analogy, to talk about a land animal, you talk about a pig and, its nose becomes a delicacy, so we kill the pig, take its nose, and just throw the rest of the pig away. I mean, it's unfathomable that we would do something like this.
Yeah, it is, because the sharks are, they're perfectly good food. People eat them in a lot of places, like, even blue sharks, which have a reputation for not being that good to eat, they make fish tacos with them in Baja California, and I've had them. They're perfectly good. So there's really no reason that we should be killing all these sharks and then just throwing away the meat when it could be feeding people.
Well, and I just want to point out that, there is a place in this world for government regulation, for governments to step in, even in international waters, because capitalism doesn't work here, because the laws of capitalism say that those shark fins are worth a lot and they take up very little space, but the laws of capitalism would lead us to simply take a whole shark, think about the size of a shark, take its fin off and throw it in the water, throw it back in the water, and that would really, makes it a very efficient killing machine of a fish boat and a huge waste. That I think anyone would consider unconscionable. And so this is an area where we need to think about things and act in a communal way, and the way we do that is through our government.
I agree with that. The problem with shark finning is it just isn't sustainable. They can just kill too many sharks doing that.
And the problem is this is one of the areas where it's in the individual's interest to kill all the sharks in the ocean, and it's to all of our detriment. Those are our sharks. That's our food source is in the ocean. You can't denude the ocean in the name of your own economic benefit. There has to be some cooperation there. If you'd like to find out more about sharks, and particularly ocean-going sharks, and what the situation is out on the ocean, you can read Dr. Babcock's book, Sharks of the Ocean Open. You can find it on our website. Dr. Babcock, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. During the break, I was online, and I was looking at Mark Vetri's restaurant in Philadelphia. Evidently, he serves shark fin soup. No, I'm kidding. He doesn't, of course, serve shark fin soup.
I'm glad that he doesn't. I was going to make a slurping noise and say, I'm finishing my soup here. I'm right done. I thought that would be important.
Okay, guys, don't. Rarely do I come up with a blanket request like this, but don't order the shark fin soup. There was a big controversy in Disney. Was it Disney Japan wanted to have shark fin soup?
Yeah.
And some good people like you called up Disney and said, okay, listen, I know authentic and all, but, they used to sacrifice virgins in some places, too. So in Aztec land, you don't sacrifice a virgin for authenticity.
Frankly, I don't have any problem with shark fin soup. But the problem is
the way they get the shark fins.
And if you said to me, well, I'm harvesting whole sharks and I'm taking the fins and we're making a special delicacy out of it, that would be fine. But in order to get that, the shark fin soup would be even more expensive if people were taking shark fin fins that way, and become even more valuable to the people who are harvesting it illegally.
But that's okay. If you got to pay for it, you got to pay for it. Mm-hmm. But the, you know, if you want to pay what it costs to take the shark fin when bringing the whole shark, I have no problem.
I totally agree.
With there being certain things that cost more than others, but if you're going to take an entire shark, think of the size of a shark.
Mm-hmm.
And throw it back in the water and waste it and not even use it for food.
I used an analogy
before, but
I'll use a better
analogy.
It's a
crime. It's a sin.
It's a sin. It's a sin, and now it's a crime.
By the way, and also with what Pope Benedict said, I think that he adds to the deadly sins environmental crimes, and I bet that would qualify under the Catholic religion as environmental crime.
It's like taking, and I used a pig analogy before, but I'll use one that's a duck analogy now. It's like fattening a duck for foie gras, taking the foie gras liver out, but not eating the duck. It seems like it just doesn't make any sense to me.
It's all wrong. We got to cooperate a little bit. We can't be throwing away each other's food, and we can't be just throwing away animals like that. We believe in raising food as food animals to kill them. We're okay with that if it's done humanely, but we need to show a little respect for it as well. Hey, everybody, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.